Oh, yeah, I will record on WebEx. So since I'm the presenter, how do I do that?
Do you see a record button?
No.
Oh, okay, it's for me. I'm going to try. Sometimes when I try to record with the video and everything, I
just... I have something here that says audio, but I'm a little afraid. That's audio conference dialogue. It's probably not a good idea. Okay, fine. I actually, I do show as well, in fact, kind of loudly. Let me turn down the volume a little. Okay, so maybe that works. All right, well, I'm sorry, everybody, for the difficulties, and since I seem to have been the cause. That's how it is, I guess. Okay, I and that is... ...some things and acknowledge that... session these 4 weeks, but next week I am going to do it. I see it on the horizon, so you'll hear from me. Okay, well, let's start off. So I wanted to go over some of the material from the previous chapter because we had a very interesting discussion last week, but not specifically about the reading. So I wanted to make some points there, and given that we've lost so much time, that's mostly what we'll talk about, I think. That's okay. I'll cover the rest of it then in the orientation. I do want you I do want us to get clear about descriptive knowledge, the way it starts off in this chapter, and we talked about it a little bit last week, and it'll come up again next week, because after all, it's a knowledge element. You know, you might say, why does it come up at all when we're talking about time? Well, we'll see. And I want to take a little bit of time to lay that out. So the relationship between descriptive knowledge and our usual ordinary understanding of time, which is essentially linear time, moment by moment, and underlying that, the sense or the model that we carry around with us of polar knowledge. There's a subject that knows, there's an object to be known, and there's an act of knowing, and that knowing takes place in the present moment, and time is made up of a series of moments, point, 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 one instant in time, one instant in time, one instant in time, and so on, as one of our famous plays says, to the last syllable of recorded time. And that's actually a nice description, because it is, in effect, recorded time that we're talking about, or, as Rinpoche talks about it here, descriptive knowledge. What happens is that the act of knowing, if we use our usual model, we say, well, the act of knowing uses the present moment up, and there's not room for anything else. So we just have this kind of bare act of polar knowledge, the subject and object, the subject knowing the object. And the result is that all we have in that moment of knowing is an act of perception. And perception by itself is just, you know, the kind of visual or sensory moment, the hearing, the seeing, the smelling, whatever it is. And then we have to identify it. And so we see a dog running down the street, and we say, that's a dog, right? Well, the tendency is to say, well, that's the present moment. Right now, in this moment, I see a dog running down the street. But there is actually a gap, and it may not sound like it makes a significant difference, but it does, and we'll talk about that. There's actually a gap. First, there's the perception of something, of a particular movement, let's say, and then we start to make sense out of that movement, and we say, oh, it's something running, oh, it's an animal, oh, it's a dog, and then maybe we know which specific dog it is. Maybe we say, it's my dog, and then we have a series of reactions related to our sense that of ownership or connection to that dog. So that act of identifying what's going on means that we have to describe what's going on to ourselves. We have to assign it to the right category. We don't necessarily do that in words. In fact, we don't usually do it in words, in the sense that a word shows up in our mind, the word dog, or we don't say a sentence to ourselves, that's a dog. We just know it. But the just knowing is nonetheless a verbal kind of thing, an identification kind of thing. There's the act of perception, and then there's what we do with the act of perception. And what we do with the act of perception is what Rinpoche refers to here as descriptive knowledge. We describe a world. So we may describe an object in the world, but like seeing the dog, but more fundamentally, we're always describing the whole situation that we're in. We're describing the whole world, the parts of it that are relevant to what we're concerned with in that moment. And it may help to think about something that, in my experience, most people have had experience with. Sometimes it seems like you're narrating your own actions. It's as though there were a voice in your head saying, and then he walked down the street and opened the door. And that's in real time. I mean, it's what's going on. Well, that's a kind of an extreme example. For those of you who've had that experience and have a sense of what I'm talking about, that's a kind of extreme example of descriptive knowledge. It's telling a whole story, and we'll talk more about stories later, and narrative later. But that's the extreme. The more subtle version of it is that what we see depends on identifying what we see, and that means we live in a world that that has a set of possibilities available to us, and we choose from those possibilities, that is the world of descriptive knowledge, and it all grows out of the sense that time unfolds from moment to moment, and the reading for the chapter goes into why that's so. Basically, because in a moment of polar knowledge, the perception uses up the present. That's our theory about how it works. It's not a theory we normally think about, but it's the way Rinpoche is suggesting that we make sense out of our usual understanding of how time goes. And it's all based on this idea of moment to moment to moment to moment. So we only choose from a set of possible possibilities. Actually, I want to tell you a story, because it just came up for me this week, and it's a little bit, I don't want to go into the details, so I'm going to kind of simplify it. It's a very simple point. There's a room I go into regularly, and there's a plant in that room. And for quite some while, I was responsible for watering the plant. So I'd always check, did it have enough water and so on. The plant was doing very nicely. And then something shifted, and my reasons for going into the room changed. I was still going into the room every day, but I stopped seeing the plant. And I didn't water it anymore. It was just gone. And that is an example of what's going on. I only discovered it 2 days ago, actually. I was, there was a string of thoughts that led me to notice the plant again. And when I did, I thought, oh my gosh, the leaves are all wilted. It's practically dead. I've killed it. Now, I've watered it, and it's actually coming back. You'll be happy to know. But the point of the story is the perception were presumably the same. You know, I would go into the room. I'd see what was in the room. The plant was very visible, big plant, not hard to see. But it just disappeared because the second stage, the stage of describing what was going on, I was describing a room that didn't have any room in it for the plant. You know, I was identifying the situation in a way that was no longer available to me. And it's that distinction and the fact that we have always moved on to the second stage where we identify something. What that means essentially is that we live in the past. We build on what's already been established. This is one time where I want to quote from the caption, you know, at the beginning of each chapter in Love of Knowledge, there are these captions. And the first four lines say, building on, building on, perpetuating, replicating, time and moments bridging. I'll stop there. Space to space contriving. That actually conveys very nicely the sense of how we're always putting something together on the basis of what we know already. That's descriptive knowledge. Now, Philip has a question or comment. If we believe what's generally accepted about the speed of light, then even at each instant of seeing the dog walking down the street, the dog is already at a slightly different place and not where we are seeing it. And that is even before the perceiving and labeling starts. Yes, that's true. And I think it just adds more force to the notion that we're always living in the past. Now, I think somebody might argue, you know, that given our perceptual apparatus, what we can see, that difference because of the speed of light is maybe not as important or central to what we're talking about. But it is very similar. What I'm talking about, the act of identifying, takes us one step further in, you could say, by going to the perceptual process. You know, the neurons in the brain have to process the information that's coming in through the eye. So there's more delay built in there. And then there's maybe, you could say, a third level of delay, which is really more central to what we're talking about, which is that having processed it, I have to somehow, you could say, match it up with the set of possible descriptions that are available to me. So it's a dog. It's not something else. You might wonder on that description, you know, how do we ever have a new perception or how do we ever have a new thought? And it is kind of problematic in terms of our usual description. It's very hard to make sense out of how that happens. The very fact that it does happen suggests that our usual description is leaving something important out of account. But that's why it says in the chapter that the question, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but investigating the truth of polar knowledge means asking whether we are free. Because if in fact we live in a world which is the descriptive world, the world that's been described, that we describe to ourselves, not in words, but we've laid it out, the only choice we have is to choose among the things that are already established. And maybe not even that, but, you know, for our purposes, that's enough. All the choices have already been made. It's already too late. You know, we're no longer really living in our lives. We're living in the story of our lives. We're living in the past version of our lives. It's a very discouraging, kind of dispiriting way of thinking about things. There's another story, but it would take too long to tell. So, okay. That world, the world that we describe to ourselves, if we can kind of entertain the idea, we don't have to accept the truth, but just entertain the idea that that's the world we usually live in, you know, that's the world we use to get places, to go around. You know, I get out of my chair and I walk to the door and I walk down the hall and so on. And all of that is the background that I can just take for granted. And it's all because it's, you know, it's been described in advance. And that's fine. You know, we wouldn't want to, let go of that because we'd be pretty helpless. You know, if we couldn't describe, if we had to kind of rethink every single thing, or if we had to kind of, well, not rely on what's already established, we couldn't really function. There's no problem there. But the problem is that we haven't yet touched the dynamic of time. Or you could say we haven't yet entered a realm where it's possible to be free. That's also, you know, those two ways of saying it are equivalent, because the dynamic of time is what makes freedom possible. And that's one very key reason why we're really wanting to develop a new vision, a new understanding. We would like to find a way to connect with the dynamic of time. Now, people are kind of aware of this problem, and you do see a lot of things nowadays which will talk about the importance of living in the present, or the power of now, that famous book by Eckhart Tolle. So you might say, well, we need to find a way to be able to really engage the present and not rely on our past constructs. And there may be ways to do that. So, you know, a lot of people are interested in sharing knowledge about how you could connect with that. But you really need to be able to you need to ask the question, how is it possible? Given this notion that we're always just living in a world that we've described to ourselves, that we're already in the past, it's well and good to say, how could you do it? Let's find a way to get into the present, but we haven't had any clue yet as to how we could actually contact direct experience. So you might say, well, we just do. We don't have to describe things to ourselves. And let me just give an example that I think goes in this direction. And it's one that I use when I teach meditation. I mean, it's very basic meditation points, not something special to what I say. If you're watching your breath in meditation, saying it that way, saying, I'm watching my breath, or I'm breathing, actually already commits us to this past-centered way of understanding, this descriptive knowledge. We have a sense that, you know, the object of our awareness, the object of our meditation is the breathing. And so now we've already set up the subject and object structure of polar knowledge. And based on that, we're going to be, whatever moment of breath we experience is in the past. So we've lost the connection to the present. So the alternative would be to say, and this, of course, is just a verbal description, so the alternative is not to describe it differently, but to experience it differently. The alternative would be to say, there's breathing, right? And again, we don't say those words to ourselves, but maybe a good way of saying it is, it's not that I am aware of breathing, it's that the breathing breathes. There is a kind of the activity of breathing carries awareness with it. And when you describe things in that way, or when you have that kind of experience, it seems like you move out of the descriptive knowledge model that's more connected with the dynamic of time. So that's important, and I think it's a reason that people practice meditation. Or, you know, there's many ways in which you can connect with time, kind of drop the description and just be present. But you have to ask some questions. You have to ask, well, first of all, it seems like That's not so easy to do. Second, suppose you have that experience while you're sitting in meditation, how does it engage the rest of your life, right, once you're off the meditation cushion? And suppose you have that experience, how long does it last? You know, maybe if you really go do sustained meditation, maybe you can maintain that for quite some time. But typically, people, when they meditate, I think they may have a little experience of that, and then, then not so much. Then something else comes up, and you have to find your way back. So all I'm saying really is that I'm not questioning the importance of meditation. I'm just saying it's not so easy. It's not the approach that you find in TSK, even though there are some meditative practices associated with TSK. Asudi asks or describes, the intimacy with what is happening consumes the subject and the object. That's right. So when you have that kind of complete intimacy, there's no room for a subject and an object. Now, it's interesting, when you say it that way, then maybe you have to say, we're still following the usual model. We're saying, well, now in the present moment, it's not used up by the subject knowing the object. It's used up by the intimacy of the experience, the breathing experience. And that's fine. But having said it that way, we realize, you know, we're still kind of following along with the usual model, the usual understanding of time. So if you look actually in the, just on the first page of this chapter that was assigned for last week, if you look at the second paragraph, the second sentence, the second half of the paragraph, that's a description. The perceiver's, it's a very nice description, I think, of what we're talking about. The perceiver's momentary contact with the perceived. So that's the polar knowledge model. Distributed across past and present. So there are moments, one moment of perceiving, the next moment of perceiving, is in some way made accessible to the self, which in turn makes use of it to structure a world of identities, interpretations, meanings, and values. So that's the world we live in, moment by moment by moment. And of course, there's a lot of weight on the words here, in some way made accessible to the self. First of all, in some way, but it's kind of mysterious unless we go farther. And also, it's made accessible to the self. But the question is going to be, well, if something happens and then it's made accessible to the self, aren't we caught up in the same problem? So that's why the way out of that in terms of meditation seems to be a kind of intimacy of experience in which it's not the self that's having an experience, it's simply the experiencing. So Klaus asks a question, what powers the coming out of meditation? Yeah, that's a great question. It's something that it relates very much to a way of talking about experience that is used in the first TSK book. It's what he calls there the coming out tendency of the self. There's a kind of intimacy of experience, but the self is always coming out of that intimacy. And if you ask what power is that coming out, I think the right way to phrase that is what motivates it? Why don't we just stay in the intimacy of experience? Something leads us to let go of that intimacy and move into something else. And I think it's basically the needs and concerns of the self. Now, we're not, I think maybe let's try to talk a little bit further today, bring that into connection with the self. In doing that, I'm going to have to sacrifice the doing a practice, but I pretty much thought we had to do that anyway because of the 15-minute delay in getting started. I do want to call attention to the exercise that was assigned for this week. and use it as a way of showing what I think is at stake here. The exercise, remember, exercise 22 in Love of Knowledge, point of transition is what it's called. And the point is this, there's a moment of experience, which is the perception of experience, you could say. And then there's another moment of experience, and maybe that second moment of experience, let's just assume, is the identification experience, right, where we assign an identity. So now we have descriptive knowledge available to us. Both those moments are kind of full by themselves. That's what this chapter is talking about. But the suggestion in the exercise is that there's something else going on. There's a link between the first moment and the second moment. And in this chapter, there's a sentence on page 114 where Rinpoche writes, the structure of human experience depends fundamentally on just such linkages. So exercise 22 invites us to look into that linkage. But the tricky part is that the link can't be another moment. It can't participate in this subject-object experience. So you might say that the link has to do with the... I think you have to say the link is the dynamic that powers this transition. What we're doing is getting in touch with the dynamic. And that, again, may come up in meditation if you can drop the identification, drop the description, and go into this greater intimacy, which is a theme that Rinpoche explores, especially in the first TSK book. That intimacy, which is a kind of aliveness, is really what we're looking at when we talk about the transition from moment to moment. But in terms of our ordinary understanding, it's just kind of a mystery. Somehow it happens. The dynamic of time really is a mystery and it's a mystery in the very simple sense that you can't describe it. The moment you describe it, you've turned it into an identified object, and now it's completely lost its quality as the dynamic of time. Right? So Klaus says, the link is very open. Seeing the openness we might touch, it's quite amazing to arrive at a predictable point again. Yeah, it really is, isn't it? In other words, I mean, I think you're building on the point you made before, that aliveness, that intimacy, or that openness seems so rewarding, so inherently nourishing, that you wonder what motivates us, what leads us to come out of it and kind of fall back into our usual pattern. Well, that's what the self knows how to do. And when the self is in a situation where that's not what's going on, you might say it's a risky situation for the self. It's a confusing situation for the self. It's a fearful situation for the self. It's not where the self feels at home. Now, it may be that if we could stay connected there, it's exactly where we would feel at home. So Philip says, I think words are part of this powering out. And by powering out, I think you mean emerging back out of the intimacy, let's call it. Recently, doing the exercises of this course, I started rubbing out words from my vocabulary. So for example, breath is breathing is still the polar model, whereas dot, 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 helps me toward intimacy, openness, and presence. Right, so in the breathing, that's good. You know, in the breathing, you don't need any kind of description. And in fact, you know, if you tune in to that, the intimacy of breathing, let's say, words fall away. And you maybe can help that by taking a more active rubbing out role. That's good, that's fine. I was going to have us do an exercise, and I think I'll just put it into the orientation. I think it's fairly easy to describe, so maybe you can experiment with it during the week. We don't have time to do it now. So that gives us then a couple of minutes. I'll go on a couple of minutes longer. I hope that's okay. I do it regularly anyway, so by now you're probably used to it. To talk about the reading for this week, which is very short. So that's chapter 22. And it starts again with the notion of descriptive knowledge. Let me see if I can find it quickly. The thing that's important here, or that we want to look at, is that there's a movement beyond descriptive knowledge and into the narrative of the self. So that's another step we make, and it's a very fundamental step. And narrative here, you could also use the word story, although I think narrative is actually better, because the idea here is you're making sense out of things through telling a story. That's the narrative. And the narrative links together moments. And the narrative is always about the self. And it's based on descriptive knowledge. So if we take a look at that, in the second paragraph on page 179, Rinpoche says, in ordinary experience, the temporal thread, so this is the linear thread from moment to moment to moment, is interwoven with the identity of the self as the I am. And that I am is the link. And again, a private message from CCI, from Medicine Kathleen. It says right here, you know, the link between, in the second paragraph, the link between past, present, and future depends on this I am, which binds together moments in time and patterns human affairs. Now, it's interesting that he uses the word link. We've been talking about how are moments in time linked. And what's being suggested here is that clearly, somehow, you need to link moments in time, and there are two possibilities. One possibility is to link them through the narrative of the self, which is also the claim that the self makes to stand at the center of the story. That links moments. That's very different from the link, the transition from one moment to the next that is kind of inherent to the dynamic of time. And that distinction, it really has a lot to do with the question that people have been raising here, which is, why do we come out of that intimacy with the dynamic of time, and instead go back into the world of the self? Well, it's exactly because that's what the self knows how to do. That's what we know how to do. And this other thing, even though it's very nourishing, you know, people who meditate and have that kind of experience, I think they find it very rich and fulfilling. The self is, you could say, always kind of monitoring, always checking in and taking over and saying, okay, I'll take over now. I'm in charge now. Let me explain what's going on. Let me give you the narrative of what's going on. So Michael asks, could the self be like water, capable of assuming the states of vapor, water, ice? Or is the self inherently a frozen phenomenon? If so, does the self briefly dissolve in the kind of holistic experience that can come in meditation? Yeah, I would go more with the latter. I mean, it's possible, I suppose, you know, maybe it's just a matter of description, but the second description seems more accurate to me, that the self freezes phenomena, but it does so in a very particular way that makes it seem as though there's still a dynamic going on. It's just the dynamic of the story that the self is telling, and that dynamic is really unfolding in the past. You know, the self stories are, they're about the past, the present, and the future. Our concerns are about the past and the present and the future. But the, I'm going to say this now, I can't really go into it, but it seems to me that it's a past-centered dynamic that the self makes use of in narrative. So we're used to thinking of dynamic as being in the present, but the self's dynamic, I would say, is really centered in the past. Now we're going to look at the self in a lot of detail, not in this session, not in the next session, but in the one after that, we'll spend the whole session looking at the self. So I'm going to give you a variation to explore in addition to that other practice that we'll look at this. The summary point to make, I suppose, is that our sense of existing in the present is really a kind of a construct. It's based on descriptive knowledge on the one hand. It's based on this narrative through which the self organizes the moments of descriptive knowledge on the other hand. And as long as that's in operation, there really is no present moment that we can touch. The present moment that we kind of theorize when we talk about polar knowledge and the act of perception is not really a present moment. It may not be a present moment at all, but it's definitely not a present moment that the self can engage because there's no room. It's already used up. The moment's already used up. The self can only engage our experience in this subject-object model and, you know, by claiming to take the role of the subject. So that's the dilemma we find ourselves in. Now, we're going to turn next to two units on knowledge, and we're going to explore the fact that this dilemma, it really comes out of the fact that we have a certain model, a certain way of understanding, and we want to understand what it means to have a model, what it means to rely on models, and what limitations it imposes. So we'll stop there for today. Again, I apologize for the difficulties at the beginning, and please do look at the orientation. I'll lay out a couple of things there that I think are helpful. Okay, so it seems as though the recording has worked fine. Recording now.
Thank you, Jack. Thank you, buddy. Thank you, Jack. Bye, everybody. It was all an adventure.
Thanks for using WebEx. Please visit our website at www.webex.com.